know what enrages her. I know when there will be hell to pay. I'm going to insist that all further communications must go through me. Are you all right with that? Donahue asks. I don't care, Lucy says. I need you to care. It's better not to. I don't need you to be afraid, but I do need you to care. I'm not afraid, and I don't care. Not the way they want me to. I need you to care the way I want you to, Donahue says, and she gives more instructions. Don't return to the main house until they're gone. If they want to interview you, well, I shouldn't indicate that they might not. Sure, you should indicate it. Lucy rudely cuts her off. That's exactly right, because the bigger worry is they don't want to question me, interview me, hear my side of anything, that it was never their intention. They don't care what I have to say. All they care about is making some case that fits with their petty politics. I'm assuming they want to ask you questions. I'll insist that we set up a formal time and they can do it at my firm. Donahue's not an alarmist, and she doesn't accept what Lucy just said. In Jill Donahue's playbook, everybody wants to ask questions. The FBI wouldn't turn down the chance to interrogate Lucy, especially if they thought they could trip her up or corner her into a lie. If they can't send her to prison for crimes she didn't commit, maybe they can manipulate her into making false statements. It's what I call playing the legal lottery. My answer is, don't let them put a nickel in your slot machine. Don't ever give them a chance to get lucky. What are you going to do about a phone? Donahue is asking my niece. It's been returned to the factory settings. What Lucy is saying is that she's made sure her phone self-destructed after Aaron Loria took it from her. It's in the exact condition it would be if they bought it brand new in a store, she adds. By the end of the day, I'll have a different number for you to reach me on securely, privately. And they won't know what you've done? That you've acquired another device, another phone? Acquiring another phone isn't against the law. I can do it all day long, and whatever they find out? Lucy stares defiantly at her. I'll just continue to defeat them. This is war. They've invaded my property and my life, and I'm not going to let it go. They want to spy on me? They want to take me on? They think they're going to leave me defenseless on my own property with Carrie Grethen on the loose? Really? Let's see what happens. Be careful. They can arrest you. Donahue is blunt with her. They have the power of the justice system on their side, and you have nothing but your vigilantism and anger. Vigilantism and anger. An eloquent way to describe it. And you should be careful, too. Especially about trivializing what you don't completely understand. I intend to understand everything. But you need to do as I say. Gee, that's the one thing I'm not good at. Lucy touches my arm. Come on, she says to me. Let's go unblock the driveway. Chapter 26. Outside on the dock, the air is steamy and thick. I feel electricity. I smell the rain as veins of lightning shimmer in a black sky that soon will have its way with us. I know an advancing big storm when I see one, and we're gonna get a whopper. I hope there's no hail. This summer, there have been violent late afternoon thunderstorms, and hail as big as marbles has beaten the hell out of my yard. It's knocked several slate tiles loose from the roof and dented the new drain pipes I recently installed. We're gonna be slammed, but good. I look up and realize how quiet it's gotten, and I remember the helicopter is gone. At least there's something positive to come from nasty weather. Listen, you can hear the peaceful sounds of the countryside again. You can't, really, and I'm being just a little sarcastic. What I hear is the wind gusting through trees and our footsteps on the wooden dock, and the plashing of the river against its pilings. But I say whatever I want, because at this stage, Lucy and I are no longer having an honest conversation. We're manipulating, but not in the same way. Not hardly. Lucy is angrily and aggressively acting out, while my every word is calculated with a very decided impression in mind. I imagine Erin Loria watching and listening. She won't get anything helpful from me. Mostly, I intend to load her up with what I call deadwood that's too flimsy to build anything from and too green to burn. One big fishing expedition. Lucy walks slowly, considerately, so I can keep up with her. I'm sure Desi loved the idea of fishing with Marino one of these days. I try to deflect what I already know Lucy will do next. She's going to dish on the FBI. She's going to have her brand of fun. She's homicidally angry, and this is what she does. She flaunts and taunts. She goads and inflames. She does it recklessly and with no regard for consequences. It's who my niece is. She's grown up, and she's not, and never will be. To catch me at whatever they miscalculate I might do, she says loudly. For what they foolishly hope I've been up to when no one's looking, such as, let me see. Oh, I know, digging a hole to China, that must be it. Thus the aerial search. That tactical bird of theirs is equipped from soup to nuts, including GPR, ground-penetrating radar. I'm sure they were hoping to detect underground safe bunkers or safe rooms or wormholes. She boldly, loudly, and in a hostile voice recites the exact wording of the warrant. Any hidden doors, egresses, including but not limited to structures, dwellings, elevators, or passageways, which are partly or wholly below ground or separate from the main residence. Yes, I answer with more platitudes and vagueness. It's what I call the kitchen sink scenario. Ask for everything. Precedence, Lucy announces as we reach the driveway. Never forget the way their robotic, rigid mind works. They think in precedents that have nothing to do with relevance or truth. It has to do with whatever else has been done, as opposed to what should be or could be done. What we think of as a cover-your-ass way of life. If you're never an original thinker, how can you possibly get in trouble? If you're banal and unoriginal enough, you'll get promoted. We walk past surveillance equipment attached to lampposts and in trees. She doesn't care in the appropriate, prudent way she should. In fact, she's looking directly into the cameras. If a hidden safe room has been found in some other case, then they're gonna list it no matter how ridiculous. Lucy talks much too openly and snidely, and no signal I send her is going to do any good. A couple years ago, there was a drug bust in Florida that became a huge mess on appeal and was all over the news. The feds were executing a routine search and found an escape tunnel and other hidden surprises they weren't looking for and hadn't included on the warrant. More recently, there was a case involving an escape hatch. The popular thing to look for these days are secret rooms and tunnels, especially in the drug business. You may also recall that tunnel dug from San Diego to Mexico. It even had train tracks. The drug business? I'm breathing hard from exertion, and the dew point and humidity must be almost the same. The air is saturated. It feels like a steam room. Since when has that subject come up? I ask. Who thinks that? They're not thinking. What they do is harass and bully, Lucy almost shouts. And I imagine Erin Loria watching and getting incensed. They're looking for anything that might give me the ability to disappear from here right under their nose. Poof! Because we all know I have a looking glass like Alice. I have a bat cave like Bruce Wayne and a phone booth like Clark Kent. The fucking Bureau of Investigation is looking for anything that might give me the ability to make my getaway or hide something from them. The walk in this direction is downhill. And that's not easy for me either. I watch what I'm doing. I'm cautious about my body language and what I might say, and I wish Lucy would be the same way. She's taken off like a bomber jet, and I'm not going to stop her. Lucy has a point to make. Or maybe it's more of a threat. You should try Benton, she says. It will be interesting to see if you get him. I wish she wouldn't act like this. And of course she knows me far too well. She knows I'm thinking about him, wondering what he's been doing while his employer pillages his family's privacy and possessions, while the FBI eviscerates the lives of the people he loves, while we are out here miserable and about to get rained on. And I'm hurt in a way I won't say. Right this moment, I'm unhappy with him. I feel abandoned by him, possibly betrayed. I feel I might yell at him if I got him on the phone, and the wind gusts hard, sending pollen, dirt, and leaves skittering over the blacktop. Are you crying? Lucy looks over at me. It's all this stuff blowing around out here, I explain as I wipe my eyes with my shirt sleeves. Go ahead and call him, she encourages, and I don't respond. Really? Go ahead. You might not have gotten him a half hour ago, but I'll bet you will now. As if you have reason to know. Go on. I'll bet you $20 you get him. I try Benton's cell phone, and he answers. I don't say hello. I tell him I'm on Lucy's property. I've been here for the past hour and a half, and will be heading back to Cambridge shortly. I know where you are, Kay. Benton's mild baritone voice is quiet and friendly, but I know he's not alone. I'm well aware of what you've been doing. Are you all right? Where are you? We landed at Hanscom. We were forced to with this weather moving in. Conditions have deteriorated extremely fast, and you shouldn't be out in it either. Benton was up in the helicopter, and Lucy suspected or knew it for some reason. It explains her cryptic comment to me about his ability to answer the phone right now when he might not have been able to a while ago. He's with his FBI colleagues, the same agents who followed Marino and me from Chanel Gilbert's house in Cambridge. Yes, I'm aware of the chopper, I say next, and I'm answered with silence. Can you offer an explanation? I ask. And he says nothing. When Benton is like this, there's no point in my probing because he's not going to respond in a helpful way, not over the phone, not with other agents within earshot. What I generally resort to is making statements. Now and then he'll address those, and my thought process picks up speed, and I concentrate more intensely. I have to worry about what both of us say because people are listening. You're not going to tell me what's going on. I try again. No. You're not alone. I'm not. Is there interest in my Cambridge case from this morning? Because unless I was looking at the wrong helicopter, you were in the area while we were there. I go ahead and say that much, and instantly I sense he won't answer, and he doesn't. I'm sorry you're breaking up, Benton says instead. I'm probably not. But next I pose the same information as a statement, summarizing. You're interested in my Cambridge case, the house on Brattle Street. I avoid mentioning the suspected name of the dead woman or any other details. I agree it's interesting. I'm not aware that it's a federal concern. It makes sense that you're not aware of it, he says in a pleasant voice. I don't have answers yet. A lot of questions, but no answers yet, I repeat. I see. For example, suffice it to say there are a number of things, and I'm concerned about confidentiality, Benton. What I mean is, I don't have privacy. He doesn't ask me to elaborate. I do anyway, but I'm appropriately understated. I haven't autopsied her, and I need to do a second walkthrough of the scene as soon as I'm done here. I was interrupted earlier. I understand. But he can't really understand. And then it enters my mind again. Does he know about the depraved heart videos? I continue to wonder if Carrie Grethen has sent them to anyone else, including the FBI. Will I see you tonight? I ask. I'll call you later, he says. And then he's gone, and I study an angry sky that looks punishing. Lucy and I have reached her open gate. Parked in front of it are two white SUVs, engines idling as their FBI drivers wait for us. I recognize one of them as the agent I had words with earlier, and I don't smile or nod. He glares at me, his polo shirt sweat-stained, his angry face shiny, and I unlock my truck and climb inside. I crank the engine, and it rumbles loudly to life as I call my forensic radiologist, Anne. I want to know if anything unusual has turned up on Chanel Gilbert's CT scan, because now I'm suspicious. The FBI is interested in her, and I want to figure out why, and I can't be overheard inside my truck with its rolled-up windows and loud engine. I can talk freely. I need to make this quick, I say to Anne, as I check my mirrors. In a few minutes, we're heading back to the Gilbert house. Is there anything I should know? It's not up to me to decide the manner of death, she says, but I'm voting for homicide. Tell me why. I back up so I can maneuver off to the side, leaving room for cars to pass in and out of the gate. I don't see how it's possible she fell from a ladder, Dr. Scarpetta. Not unless she fell from it 3 or 4 times. She has multiple depressed skull fractures that extend into the paranasal sinuses, the structures of the middle ear, plus underlying areas of hematoma. How are we doing with her identification? Dental charts are on the way. It's her. I mean, who else would it be? Let's get it confirmed. I'll let you know the instant we do. Has Luke started her post? He's in the middle of it. I open the screen of the laptop built into the console between the two front seats, and in a moment, I'm logged into the CFC's closed camera system. A network of fisheye panoramic domes in the ceiling of every room of the intake and examination areas. It allows me to monitor what my doctors and forensic investigators are doing at any given time. I type in my password, and the computer screen splits into quadrants that cover each workstation in autopsy room A, which is where Luke and I work. I hear the whine of the striker saw inside a vast space of bright overhead lights, glass observation galleries, and stainless steel. I see Luke at his station, suited up in a teal-green gown, an apron, a face shield, and surgical cap. Our two medical residents are across the table from him, and Harold is sawing open Chanel Gilbert's skull, the oscillating blade grinding as he cuts through thick bone. It's Dr. Scarpetta. I've got you up on my screen, I say, as if I'm talking to people inside the truck. Hello? Luke looks up at the camera in the high ceiling, and the glare of the face shield makes it hard to see his handsome face and vivid blue eyes. The body has been opened from the clavicles to the pubic bone, the block of organs on a cutting board, and Luke is snipping open the stomach with a pair of surgical scissors. He pours the contents into a plasticized paper carton. I tell him I'm checking on how the case is going, and explain that I'll be returning to the scene shortly. And is there anything I should know? Is there anything special I should look for? You definitely should check for multiple impact areas. His voice, with its heavy German accent, sounds from the laptop inside the truck. I'm assuming you've seen the images on CT. Anne has given me a quick summary. The diesel engine rumbles in my bones as I talk to the laptop's screen. But I haven't viewed the actual scans yet. She doesn't think Chanel Gilbert is an accident. She has contusions and abrasions of the scalp, which you can clearly see in areas where I've shaved her hair. He rests his bloody gloved hands on the edge of the table as he talks to me. Posteriorly, temporally. Obviously, I've not looked at her brain yet, but on CT there's subgaleal hematomas of the left parietal temporal and right occipital areas, and a coupe contusion, in addition to diffuse subarachnoid hemorrhage. Her fractures are complex, suggesting a lot of force, a high velocity, and multiple impact points. Consistent with hard impacts, such as someone beating her head against a marble floor. Yes, and what I'm just now seeing might be helpful. He holds up the carton of gastric contents. I'm zooming in. It's as if I'm inches away, and I can make out approximately 200 milliliters of what looks like a lumpy vegetable soup. What appears to be seafood, possibly shrimp, and greenish peppers, onions, some rice. He pokes through it with the scalpel, Something she must have eaten not long before she died. It's barely begun to digest. What about a stat alcohol? Nothing much. 0.03. Maybe she had a glass of wine with dinner. Or it could be from decomposition. She certainly wasn't impaired, at least not by booze. I'll check to see what's in her refrigerator. I'm on my way back there. I log off the computer, cut the engine, and climb out of the truck. Lucy has parked Donahue's big Mercedes sedan out of the way, and she trots over to me. Come on, she says. I want to show you something. Chapter 27. We walk around the south wing of the house, where a narrow grassy strip of yard gives way to dense woods. A 10-foot-high chain-link fence is coated in dark green PVC and anchored by heavy steel poles driven deep into the earth. Lucy unlocks a gate as another FBI SUV disappears down the driveway. There are only two government vehicles still parked in front of the house. One of them must belong to Erin Loria. I've been watching for her. I'm sure she's still here. She wouldn't miss it. Be careful, Lucy says. There's plenty to trip over. The land scalpers never come in here, so it's really overgrown. I follow her through the gate, and then we're in the woods. There's no gradual transition. Her yard ends at the fence, and on the other side of it are acres dense with rhododendron, mountain laurel, and old trees. Trails winding through were cleared long years ago and are mostly overgrown. I move very carefully, slowly along a vague scar of a path as Lucy leads us through ferns, birches, and dogwoods. Then she stops. There. She points at a holly tree, at a white pine with motion sensor cameras and lights on them. Several times now they've been activated by movement, but there's nothing there. The cameras aren't picking up anything. I'll ask what I have before, I reply, and I realize why she's brought me here. Couldn't an animal be to blame? I have the sensors set to react to anything moving that's at least 3 feet off the ground, like a deer, a bear, a bobcat, she says, as I stand very still, bearing most of my weight on my left leg. Something that size, and the cameras would pick it up. But they didn't. Lucy is putting on a show. Whatever she has in mind is the go-screw-yourself grand finale, and any minute now the fireworks will begin. She's deliberately dressed in FBI sweats, and if that wasn't enough, she's about to do more. But it doesn't explain the strange object I'm noticing so close to her feet she's about to step on it. At a glance, it could be a tiny raindrop on top of brown leaves beneath a mountain laurel. But it's not raining yet. Don't move, I say under my breath. I hold her stare, making sure she understands, and she does. I steady myself next to a clump of sassafras trees, grabbing onto a smooth trunk. Mitten-shaped, pale green leaves brush against me, and I casually comment that in another month or so, they will turn yellow, coral, and orange. Lucy's property will be fiery with fall colors, I say good-naturedly for the benefit of eavesdroppers, and then the snow will come, and there can be no invisible intruders because they'll leave tracks. Unlike whoever has been here, I say not just to Lucy, but to the FBI. And I know someone was, I continue to announce, as I dig in the pockets of my cargo pants and find a pair of fresh gloves. Pulling them on, I steady my balance as I bend over, moving as little as possible so I don't disturb the underbrush or leaves and lose what I'm trying to collect. The small bit of what looks like quartz sticks to my gloved index finger, and I cup my other hand under it to make sure it doesn't fall or sail off on a gust of wind. I can't help but think it miraculous that something no bigger than a grain of rice was plainly visible, and I suspect it hasn't been out here long. Unless you're the source, I say to Lucy, then someone has been in this spot. Probably very recently. The tiny flat hexagon is dull and opaque, and I hold it in my palm to show Lucy. It's not polished and looks industrial, bringing to mind a mineral or other material used in manufacturing or engineering. Do you have any idea? I ask. I didn't notice it when I was out here looking around. She stares as if it's poison. I didn't see it until you did just now. I'm surprised it's here. She says it oddly. Maybe it's supposed to be. That's my first thought. We're supposed to find it. She says it slowly, loudly, making sure the FBI doesn't miss a word. It couldn't come from anything you own. I move it to the palm of my hand so she can get a closer look. You sure it's not from you or something you've installed? What about your surveillance system? It was very close to several cameras. This isn't from anything of mine. It's certainly not from me, because I wouldn't be so careless and stupid as to leave it out here. She's careful not to touch it or get too close. But she's not careful about much else. Lucy is glancing around at the cameras in the trees. She's boisterous and cheerful, as if we're having a happy nature hike or a picnic. It doesn't look like anything from normal clothing. I stay on subject. Not from anything decorative either. It's been micro-machined into this size and shape, and there's a tiny hole through it. Possibly something was threaded through it. She's been here. Carrie Grethen has been. I confirm who she means, and Lucy nods. This is from something she's doing. I'm not sure what, but I have an idea what this relates to, Lucy says. Carrie was always chasing after invisibility. Lucy suspects that what I found is a metamaterial possibly used in creating objects that bend and diffuse light. Let's see what it is after the labs do their thing, but I'm guessing it's laser-quality quartz, in other words, calcite, Lucy says. Then you've seen something similar before. I'm well aware of what's out there. She's always been obsessed with invisibility technology, what's known as augmented reality or optical camouflage. Lucy looks around, as if she's talking to the trees. These idiots are so hell-bent on going after me, they aren't paying any attention to the real danger. Carrie may have figured out how to cloak herself, with the goal in mind that she can take out anyone she wants. I mean anyone. And she's a damn terrorist, so that could concern the damn FBI. Lucy has no concern about being even moderately discreet. In fact, she's not really talking to me anymore. She's talking to them. She's talking to Aaron Loria. This is where the motion sensors went off yesterday about 4 a.m., and then again this morning at the same time. She projects her voice, and her tone is peppered with mockery, and beneath that is rage. When the sun was up, I did a walk around. Everything looked normal. Could she have been here in this spot and you didn't see her? She could have been, especially if she's rigged up something Harry Potter-ish, but it's not fantasy. They're engineering all sorts of materials these days that can change reality as we know it. I think reality's already been changed. I don't have my scene case with me, so I improvise. Possibly for good. Finding another clean glove, I drop the metamaterial inside and shake it down into one of the fingers. I tightly roll up the purple nitrile and tuck it into my pocket, noticing that directly ahead through the fence are the south windows of Lucy's master suite. If someone had binoculars with night vision capabilities, it could be a problem. Is that the way they usually are? I point at her bedroom, and what I'm asking is if she always keeps the shades down. It doesn't matter. A scope with ultrasonic sensors can basically see through walls, she replies in the same stage voice. The purpose of a system like that is to continue to track targets after they duck behind cover. Who would have such a thing? I interrupt her as I feel a wave of impatience. I'm tempted to tell her to keep her voice down, but I won't. It's unwise for me to give any sign that I suspect the FBI is watching and listening. I know better than to behave as if I feel guilty and have things to hide, so I continue to talk thoughtfully, what sounds like openly and comfortably. But I'm careful and deliberate, and Lucy isn't. She doesn't have a flight switch, only a fight one. And that's what I'm witnessing and can't begin to control. She's been here. I can promise you that. She says it with certainty and audacity, and I see the aggression in her intense green eyes. Somehow she's been right here, using some sort of technology for a specific reason. Maybe to spy. I don't know, but it's not the feds. They're not that smart. It's Carrie. She might be somewhere out here right this minute, but they'll never believe it. Maybe no one believes it's her, because why would anyone want to? Even my own partner isn't sure. I understand how painful this must be for Janet, but I don't say it out loud. It's not necessary for me to remind Lucy of her history with Carrie, of all the years that have passed with us feeling safe because we were certain she wasn't a danger to us or anyone anymore. We need to go. Lucy looks up at storm clouds that have rolled in like a charcoal tarp, hanging low with tatters reaching down, a total gloom descending. Okay, we're leaving, she says loudly, and not to me, but to whoever is listening. We head back carefully, not talking now. The wind gusts harder, and the smell of rain is so strong I can taste it as I think about everything I need to do. I'll get the metamaterial to my labs later today. At the very least, I'll confirm what it's made of, but already there are problems. I didn't collect evidence according to my own unforgiving protocols. My DNA might be on the metamaterial, or possibly Lucy's could be. If nothing else, a competent defense attorney will claim that what I just collected is contaminated because it was improperly handled. The jury won't trust it or me. The first drops of rain smack the trees as we emerge from them back onto the grass. In the distance, building thunderheads flash with lightning, flickering purplish-black like something shorting out, like something wounded. I smell ozone and feel the dropping barometric pressure pressing down heavily, and I'm startled by what I don't understand at first. Music explodes out of the audio surveillance microphones all over the property. Hoser's "Take Me to Church" is as loud as an air raid in the woods, around the house, over the water. I look at Lucy, and she's smiling as if we're out on a happy stroll. She doesn't have her phone. She's not at the controls anymore. Janet must be responsible. And I step up my pace as the music rocks 50 acres of conservation land. Pain screams in my leg, and I accept that I'm going to get soaked. I tell Lucy to run ahead out of the downpour, but she mimics my pace. She stays with me, and in a matter of seconds, the bottom of the universe seems to burst in an explosion of thunder that sounds like gunfire. Rain pours down in the blasting wind. The temperature has dropped at least 10 degrees, and Hoser is all around us, as if God is enjoying a concert at the FBI's expense. We were born sick. You heard them say it. I'm not the only one they have to worry about. Lucy raises her voice over the music throbbing in the rain, in the trees. Don't fuck with us, she shouts up to a rabid sky. And I imagine the FBI agents inside her house where Hoser must be deafening. I was born sick, but I love it. Then Lucy's palatial timber home instantly goes dark. I can't see a single light on. Her smart house is computerized. There are no switches in the walls. The FBI isn't controlling the audio system or the lights. Janet is. Of that I have no doubt, and Lucy is laughing in the hammering rain and music as if this is the funniest day of her life. Amen, 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 amen. Tell Marino to meet me at the truck. I head toward the driveway, my wet shirt coldly plastered to my back. You can't stay here. For a lot of reasons, you, Janet, and Desi absolutely can't. I talk over splashing water and Hoser worshiping like a dog at the shrine of your lies. You need to move in with us for a while, I yell back at Lucy. I don't want to argue about it. Chapter 28. Rain pounds the metal roof as if a mad drummer is on top of us. The early afternoon is dark. It feels like dawn or dusk. It feels like the world is about to end. I'm coming out of my skin. Something is sliding, rolling around in the back of my big white truck as I drive in the monsoon. The object is hard and metallic. It moves a short distance, hits something, then stops and rolls again, depending on which way I turn or if I slow down or speed up. I can hear it clearly through the partition that separates the cab from the boxy body, and there was no such noise this morning before I parked by Lucy's gate. It started minutes ago as we lumbered around a hairpin curve. Clank, clank, clank. We need to see what the hell that is. Marino has said this several times, but there's nothing I can do. There was no place to pull over earlier, and we're on Route 2 now in heavy rain and Friday traffic. The visibility is abysmal. Everybody has their lights on as if it's night, and even if I wanted to detour, there's nothing here. Just the highway and a big mud hole of a construction site on my right and three lanes of cars and trucks on my left. I'm mindful of the day slipping away. I seem to have very little control over anything, including my time. I can't pull over right now. I tell Marino the same thing I did when he first suggested it. It sounds like rebar rolling around. It can't be. Maybe a tool like a screwdriver or something that rolls around gets caught on something, then rolls around some more. I don't see how, I reply, and the noise suddenly stops again. Well, it's giving me a creepy feeling and fraying my last nerve. He cracks open his window to smoke, to calm his creepy feeling and soothe his fraying last nerve, and water spatters the inside of the door and the dash. I tell him I don't mind his cigarettes, but I don't want the windows fogging up. I adjust the fan, and that helps some, but I can take only so much frigid air, and Marino complains about that, too. He's hot and sweating, and I don't want to get chilled. I'm keeping the temperature barely above tepid. I make constant adjustments, clearing the glass and getting cold, then warming up and unable to see. This is stressful and uncomfortable, and it's almost impossible not to be edgy and rather frantic. My clothes are wet. I'm sticky and wilted. My leg aches miserably. I feel sick about Lucy, sick about the secrets I keep, and the debate inside me rages nonstop. Should I tell Marino about the depraved heart videos? I honestly don't know what to do. And as we drive farther away from Concord, past flooded road construction and soupy woods shrouded in mist, I force myself to concentrate on my new rule. Pay attention, even when you think you already are. It's a new rule that used to be an old one, but I got lax. I got lulled into a false sense of safety. And as I try to retrace my steps, I see the pattern. I see it plainly, and a part of me is unforgiving while another part understands how it happened. No one can be vigilant every minute of every day. Time passes, and some things get harder. I'm relentless about keeping up my scan for enemies, but the ones from the past are the most treacherous. We know too much about them. We start recreating them in our own image, assigning attributes and motivations they don't have. We form relationships with them. We delude ourselves into believing they don't want to kill us. The same thought continues to nag at me. If I hadn't assumed that Carrie Grethen was no longer on this planet, would I have stopped looking for her anyway? I worry that I might have. It's the path of least resistance to relegate nightmarish people to a cold file, to tuck them so far back in your mind that you don't think about them. You expect nothing from them. You don't fear them or anticipate or predict or worry. I dismissed Carrie long ago. I didn't do it simply because I was convinced she'd died in a helicopter crash. I couldn't stand to live with her anymore. For years, she'd invaded my psyche. She was a shadow cast by something I couldn't see, an inexplicable shift of air, a sound that made no sense. I lived with the constant expectation that my phone was going to ring and I'd get the next bad news. I waited for her to torture and murder someone else, to partner with another deviant and go on another spree. I constantly looked for her when I was with Lucy and when I wasn't. Then I stopped. "You want a hit?" Marino offers me a cigarette. "You look like you sure as hell could use it, Doc." "No, thanks." "I wonder if the music's still playing and what the feds are doing about it, because you can bet they aren't laughing." He inhales a lungful of smoke and blows it out the side of his mouth. Lucy and Janet didn't blast music and turn off the lights because they wanted to amuse anyone except themselves, I reply. Lakes and forests spread out on either side of us as we pass the town of Lexington now.
"You sure it was them who did it?" Marino asks.
"Well, it wasn't Desi."
"You'd be surprised what little kids can do with computers. It wasn't all that long ago that one hacked into the FBI database. I think the kid was like 4 or something.
Desi has nothing to do with what we just witnessed. It probably was Lucy's idea. It's the sort of thing she'd find funny." Even as I say this, I think of video links I'm supposed to believe were sent by her ICE number. I'm convinced Carrie is spoofing Lucy's phone. There's no telling what else Lucy may have hijacked, broken into, and appropriated, as if our lives are hers to manipulate, trifle with, damage, and destroy. I'm reminded of how skilled she is at creating implosions, internal failures, strife, and catastrophes. If she can cause us to self-destruct, what could be more gratifying to her than that? She's trying to script our behavior, and that's how it starts.
"I'll never get over them hiring her."
Marino is talking about Carrie with no prompting from me. "When you really think about it, the feds created Carrie Grethen like Frankenstein," he adds. And he's right, in a sense. In some ways, she was conceived, nurtured, and transformed into an amoral monster by our own government. Then she decided to turn on what took care of her, to demolish any fairness and safety she'd been entrusted to ensure in this world. She'll take any side that suits her at any given time because she has no loyalty or love for anything or anyone except herself. "A computer engineer for the Department of Justice," Marino is saying, "assigned to Quantico? And the FBI had no clue they'd placed a friggin' psychopath in charge of their computer and case management overhaul?" "What became an unfixable failure," I add. The Criminal Artificial Intelligence Network, known as CAIN, morphed into the Trilogy program, a massive effort on the part of the FBI to modernize its outdated information technology. The project was finally abandoned about a decade ago after wasting hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars, and I can't help but wonder how much of this was Carrie's fault. More precisely, I'm saying to Marino, I wonder how much was of her divining, because nothing would suit her better than to be pitted against inadequate software and data management that she in fact may have manipulated and sabotaged during its inception.
"You got that right. And exactly my point. A genius mad scientist like her," Marino says. "You really think she couldn't wreak havoc on anything she wants, especially if it's got to do with communication technology or computers?"
"So could Lucy," I remind him, and I'll just keep emphasizing that unfortunate truth. She created Kane, and virtually anything Carrie can do, so can Lucy. That's the way the FBI would think about it. That would be their justification for going after Lucy. They can blame her and assign means and motives to anything they want because she's capable. It's believable, and it suits them, let's be honest.
"Then maybe Carrie turned on the music to piss them off and get Lucy into trouble. Double the pleasure, double the fun," Marino says. "Screwing around with the sound system is like waving a red flag in front of a bull. It's not against the law, but it's stupid. We don't know that Carrie didn't do it to entertain herself. I'm not saying she isn't capable, I reply. But I'm betting it was Janet and Lucy deciding to treat Erin Loria and her compatriots to a concert. They shouldn't be doing shit like that. They're playing right into Carrie's hands. We can't let anyone determine how we act. That's true. Specifically, it's true that Carrie wants to control and change us. That's always been what she wants. And here I thought that what she wanted was all of us dead. One way or another. And eventually, that's the plan, I'm sure, I reply. Lucy needs to be careful about getting in people's faces right now. Maybe you can talk to her when things calm down. She doesn't need to be making things worse than they already are. How could they be worse, Marino? The FBI showed up with a warrant. Agents have been walking out the door with her belongings, violating her entire existence. I turn up the wipers as high as they'll go, and they sound like an angry metronome throwing a tantrum. What could be worse is they arrest her and lock her up without bail. Marino smokes the cigarette down to the filter. And don't think they can't do it. She owns a helicopter and a jet. She's a pilot. She has a ton of money. They'll argue she's a flight risk, and the judge will rule in the FBI's favor, especially if there's a judge behind the scenes who has an agenda, a federal judge like Erin Loria's husband. The first thing we should be asking is the timing for the sting operation. Why strike now? Today's date enters my mind again. August 15, the two-month anniversary of when Carrie shot me. What I say is, you're right. Why today? Or is the timing random? I don't know about random, but I also can't think of anything important. Exactly 2 months ago, Carrie attacked me. I shouldn't have to remind him. But how would that be important to the FBI? Why would that date motivate them? I don't see how it would matter. It's more likely to matter to Carrie. Well, we can be sure they're looking for probable cause to get Lucy indicted for something. I don't know what, but I think we can make an educated guess about who it relates to, Marino says. Prison would be the end of Lucy. She wouldn't survive, and Carrie would love that. Let's stay out of such a fatalistic airspace. I don't want to hear his doomsday predictions, and I can barely restrain myself from admitting the truth to him. I want to tell him about the videos, even as I continue to entertain the same troubling questions. What if the FBI has seen them? What if the FBI texted them to entrap me and anybody else I might involve? I don't know who to trust. Not even my own attorney, Jill Donahue, the more I think about it. And when I'm this unsure of anything, I'm careful. I'm deliberate and calculating. The problem is, once an investigation gets in gear, good luck stopping it. Marino is painting more fear-inducing scenarios. The feds don't let something go unless they got no choice, unless the grand jury comes back with a no bill, and that almost never happens. Lucy's goose would be cooked. No grand jury is going to have any sympathy for a fired federal agent who's filthy rich and comes across the way she does. I suggest we keep our attention on what we're doing. I absolutely can't stand to hear his dire projections about her. And I don't need him to tell me that she doesn't inspire empathy or even the benefit of the doubt. I'm just telling you the facts, Doc. He pinches out the cigarette, drops it in an empty water bottle, and lights up another one, offering it to me. Here. You need it. I think, what the hell? I take the Marlboro from him, and there are some things I've never stopped being good at. Smoking is one of them. I inhale slowly, deeply, and my emotional elevator goes up to a floor I forgot I had. It's nice. A lot of light and a view. And for an instant, I let go of gravity and it lets go of me. I hold the cigarette in Marino's direction, giving it back, and our fingers brush. I'm always surprised that his sun-weathered skin with its thick, coppery hair is soft and silky. I detect his aftershave, spicy and overlaid with the patina of sweat and tobacco smoke. I smell the wet cotton fabric of his cargo shorts and polo shirt. You ever try weed when you were young? He takes another drag, holding the cigarette as if it's a joint. You mean when I was younger? Seriously, I'm betting when you were in law school. Tell the truth. All you Ivy Leaguers hanging out smoking weed, arguing about interpretations and precedents and who's going to make law review. That wasn't my experience at Georgetown. But maybe it should have been. My tone sounds somber and distracted as I continue checking my mirrors. I stare through thudding wipers at misty lines of traffic, water spewing from tires ahead and to the left of us. I don't go above the speed limit. I'm tense, my eyes constantly in my mirrors looking for Carrie. We sweep around the Fresh Pond Reservoir, and the pockmarked surging water is the color of lead. The noise of something metal rolling in back starts again and stops, and I can't get Carrie out of my thoughts. Clank, clank, clank. What the hell? Marino says in a cloud of smoke. That's just freaking strange. Everything is inside storage lockers and containers. I go through every possibility I can think of that might account for the noise. The folded-up stretchers are strapped in. There shouldn't be anything loose. Maybe one of your scene cases came open. Maybe it's an evidence bottle, a flashlight, something like that rolling around. I seriously doubt it. Carrie appears in my mind. I see her face. I see her wide, crazed eyes and the lust smoldering in them as she cut Lucy with the Swiss Army knife. It was the same way Carrie looked at me when she fired the spear gun, and the clattering and clanging in the back of the truck continues. Marino is making the point that the noise wasn't there earlier. And no one has been inside, he's saying. I mean, there's no way anyone went inside it while we were at Lucy's? You sure? You positive the truck was locked while you were blocking that FBI asshole's car? Did one of them go inside the truck? Maybe looking for an extra key so they could move it? Did someone try to force open a door and broke something, and that's what we hear rolling around? I'm sure it was locked. I think I am, but now that he's mentioned it, I can't swear to it. Uncertainty begins to pick at me. When I packed up my equipment mid-morning, it was right after I got the first Depraved Heart video clip. Maybe I was distracted as I arranged the large plastic cases in the back of the truck. Maybe I forgot to lock the tailgate doors. It's something I do automatically, with a key that also sets and unsets the alarm. I never leave the back, the cab, or any of the access panels unlocked for a number of reasons. Defense attorneys, for example. They'd harangue me about it on the witness stand. They'd have jurors doubting the integrity of any evidence I collected, including the dead body itself. Jesus! Marino mutters, as whatever is loose in back rolls again and stops with a clank. We're almost there, I reply. I'm gonna look. Chapter 29 Cars in Cambridge are few. They move slowly with their lights on as we drive near the Harvard campus, headed back to Brattle Street, one of the most prestigious addresses in the United States. Former residents include George Washington and Longfellow, and the handsome timber-frame, two-story house where Chanel Gilbert died was built in the late 1600s. Painted a dusky blue, it's symmetrical with black shutters, a gray slate roof, and a central chimney. Over the centuries, most of the original estate was subdivided and sold off, and the only way to reach it is a shared driveway of old interlocking brick pavers in a herringbone pattern. I carefully bump along in my big truck and park in front, listening to rain pummel and splatter. As I look around, I get an uneasy feeling. I get more than one of them. They're coming in waves as trees rock and thrash in the wind and rain, and I turn off the wipers and the headlights, and the glass is flooded. Ours is the only vehicle in the driveway, and that's not right. Where is everyone? I ask, and it sounds like we're inside a car wash. Where's your backup? Damn good question. Marino is on high alert as he scans the long, narrow driveway, the front of the house, the dense old trees shaking and losing leaves in a battering wind. I thought you instructed that the property was to be secured. I did. There's not a police car in sight. And where's the red Range Rover? No kidding. This is fucked up. Marino releases the thumb snap of the black leather holster on his hip, and thunder rumbles and cracks. Did you instruct Vogel, Lappin, maybe Hyde, to have it towed to the labs? There was no reason to do that. We weren't really thinking foul play until now. Maybe Bryce took it upon himself to get it towed after you talked to Anne and Luke and decided this is a homicide. Marino is scrolling through the contact list on his phone, glancing up every other second, his eyes moving constantly. I talked to them not even half an hour ago, I remind him. There's not been time for the Range Rover to have been towed, and certainly I didn't request it, and there's no way Bryce would have. I sure as hell didn't tell anybody to tow it. He wipes condensation off the side window as he stares out, checking the big mirror for the empty stretch of rain-swept driveway behind us. The Range Rover key was on the kitchen counter, and Hyde took a quick look inside it. He said he didn't see anything interesting. In fact, there wasn't much in it at all, and it was his impression maybe it hadn't been driven in a while. That was what he said. And we didn't do anything else because we were operating under the assumption there was no crime involved, just an accident. At that time, there was no point in thinking about processing her car. What happened to the key after that? I have it, and the house key. Obviously, there's a spare, unless the Range Rover was hotwired or gotten out of here some other way. I look around to see if anything else might be missing or altered since we were here mid-morning. The centuries-old house is shrouded in a gray mist that rises up from the rain-splashed earth, and my attention fixes on the solitary strip of crime scene tape barricading the brick front steps. The flimsy yellow plastic tape shivers in the wind and rain, and it wasn't there earlier. More importantly, I notice the absence of scene tape anywhere else. It's not barricading the kitchen door we used this morning. It's not wrapped around trees or across the driveway. Then I spot a fat roll of bright yellow tape abandoned in a flower bed next to wooden bulkhead doors that I assume lead down into the cellar. Apparently, someone began securing the perimeter and stopped, leaving the roll where I see it now in a flower bed of purple asters and brown-eyed Susans that are rain-beaten and trampled. I think back to when I was alone in the entranceway, and everyone was supposed to be gone except Marino and me. I inexplicably heard what sounded like a heavy door thudding shut. The one in the basement that led out to the backyard was mysteriously unlocked, even though Trooper Vogel claimed to have deadbolted it. Next, the kitchen trash was missing, and the table was oddly set with a decorative plate taken off the wall. Now the Range Rover is gone. I stare at the old house with its dark windows of wavy glass. Maybe it's haunted, but not by a ghost. Someone has been on the property since we were here last. Didn't I hear you tell your guys to wrap this place in a big yellow bow? I say to Marino, because the only tape I'm seeing is there. I point at the front of the house. One strip tied to the railings doesn't exactly serve the purpose of keeping people out of the house or off the property. Do you know who did it and why the tape roll is over there? It's as if the person was interrupted and decided to walk around to the side of the house and left the roll in the flower bed before driving off. I can see from here that a lot of the plants near the bulkhead doors have been stepped on or crushed. Hyde or Lappin must have come back after you and me left for Lucy's place. And then what? Damned if I know. Marino is looking at his phone. I texted Hyde when we headed here and he's not answered. Nothing from Lappin either. When was the last time you heard from either one of them? I talked to Hyde when I called him about the kitchen trash maybe 3 hours ago. I'm trying him again. He blows out a breath in loud frustration when the call goes straight to voicemail. Damn it. They haven't showed up, and you've not heard from them. Are you worried? I'm not ready to go there yet. If I instigate a search for either one of them, there could be hell to pay. You want to get people into trouble and have them hate you, then that's the way to do it. What about the state police? I think of Trooper Vogel again. Is it possible they could have been here? Could they have towed a Range Rover? Hell no. And the FBI? They better not have been here without telling me. They better not have touched or towed anything. But is that possible? Could the feds have taken over the investigation and we don't know? It certainly seems they're interested. If this was their investigation, by now they'd be crawling all over the place the same way they are at Lucy's property. We wouldn't be sitting here by our lonesome. We probably couldn't get back on the driveway, much less inside the house. They were in this area earlier, up in the helicopter, with Benton. Marino can't resist reminding me uncharitably. He was flying right over us when we were here, and then more or less followed us to Lucy's. So who are they really watching? Who's he really watching? It's probably a good idea to assume the FBI is watching all of us. I kill the engine, and nor'easter force winds shake the truck as rain floods the front windshield. Let's just assume the feds believe Lucy may be implicated in what's been happening, and that I'm in collusion with her. Maybe you are, too. Maybe they have all of us on their radar. In other words, Lucy's a serial killer? Or she and Carrie both are, and we know it, but are protecting them? And Lucy shot you in the leg and swam off with your dive mask? Or maybe you shot yourself? Or maybe Benton did? Or maybe Moby Dick or a fish called Wanda are to blame? What a crock of crap. And how the hell can you be married to someone who's spying on you, treating you like a fugitive? Benton doesn't spy on me any more than I spy on him. Both of us have our jobs to do. That's as much as I'm going to explain. And I stare out at the centuries-old property in the pounding rain. The house looks dead and lonely, and I'm feeling the same thing I did when we were here earlier. It's hard to describe. Like a coldness in my diaphragm that causes me to breathe shallowly, very quietly. My stomach is clenched like a fist. My mouth is dry. My pulse is rapid. I'm questioning myself. And it's not that I never did before, but I seem to do it constantly of late. Am I picking up on real danger? Is it my imagination because I've been traumatized? But no matter what I silently analyze or debate as I sit inside the truck, I can't dispel my unsettledness. It's getting stronger with every moment that passes. I sense a malignant presence. I feel we're being watched. I think of the pistol in my shoulder bag as I keep up my scan, and Marino scrolls through his recent calls. He presses send and says, "Lappin's phone is going straight to voicemail too." He leaves a message for him to call right away, and then he says to me, "What the hell? They get beamed up by aliens?" If they're out in the middle of this weather, then they may have their phones tucked away so they don't get soaked. Or maybe they can't hear them ring. Sometimes the cell phone service is disrupted when we have storms like this. I watch large maple trees whipped and raked by the wind, the underside of their leaves flashing pale green. But should we be worried, Marino? I don't want to get them into trouble, but I'd like it all.